You're listening to Swimming World Radio. I'm your host, Brent Rutemeller. And today we have with us the International Swimming Hall of Fame great coach Peter Dallin, and now author of The History of Olympic Swimming. He has written the first of a series of books, Volume 1, which covers the Olympic Swimming Games from 1896 to 1936. And he joins us today. He's also the founder of Swimming World Magazine. Thanks for joining us, Peter.
Thank you. This is not only my new book, but it's my only book so far.
Well, on that account, let's just talk about what you envision. This is Volume 1. This book we're going to talk about today starts with 1896, which is the reemergence of the Olympic Games in Athens, and it goes to 1936. But what more do you have in store down the road here with this series?
Well, the books become different because I start mentioning some other competitions which lead up to Olympics. In the early years, there really wasn't very much, and so it's mostly just about the Olympics. And now, where I am now, I'm actually working on the 1960s, and there are some meets that definitely have a bearing on who's going to do well and who isn't going to do well in the Olympics.
I understand. So this is Volume 1, so you're in the process of writing Volume 2?
Well, Volume 2 and 3.
And 3 together.
Because we made a change in 2 that delayed its publication, and 3 is about one quarter finished.
And do you see a Volume 4?
Well, 4, 5, and 6 will come after all this.
Okay, well, very good. Well, let's dive into Volume 1, very interesting book. It's a little over 175 pages, but you go right into, talking about, the first, I guess, modern-day Olympic Games, 1896, which was in Athens, Greece. Bring the readers back to that period of time. What was going on in that period?
Well, in that period of time, there was swimming going on in Europe and a little bit in Australia and U.S. We had nationals, Australians had nationals. But in the first games, there was one statement that kind of described the conditions under which those guys were swimming. When the winner finished in the 1,200 meters, which is corresponds to the mile, and was a Hungarian fellow, Alfred Hajós, who became a very famous architect, by the way, and received an Olympic medal for his artwork, because the Olympics were more than just sports, they were culture. And this guy is the big name in Hungarian swimming. And this summer, we're going to his pool, the Alfred Hajós Center, where we'll have the European Championships. I will be present because I cover the meet for USA Swimming. I'm the Europe person. But what Hajós said, and it's the reality of those days, the meet was held in April in the Aegean Sea. That's open water with waves and salt and just like an ocean. And the race started, they launched the swimmers from the side of a boat, and then they raced for an inlet, and then they swam across the inlet to the finish line, which was a suspended rope. And Hajós won the race, and they could see he was really putting it on the line, really going hard. And the press said, "Oh, Alfred, you swam so well to get your medal." He said, "No, I didn't. I swam for my life." That Hajós he started the Olympics off with a bang. He doubled, he won the sprint, which was the 100 meters, and that was swum inside of the little harbor. and then he went outside to swim this other one, and that gave him a little rest because in between they had a 500-meter swim, and most of the competitors just folded or didn't swim at all, and the winner moved to U.S. and became a dentist, a U.S. dentist. I think he'd been in dentistry already, but he opened a practice in the Middle West.
Well, 4 years later, they end up in France. It's the 1900 Olympic Games. It's in Paris, and it's on the river. Talk a little bit about that particular Olympic.
Well, that was another one that was a little unusual, because in the Seine River, as in most rivers, there's a current. And they did times that were not equaled for 20 or 30 years because they swam with the current. And one of the events was rather interesting. It was only held once, and it was won by a little tiny Australian fella who figured out the trick. And the trick was you had to get across a floating boat, and partway through the race, you climbed up on the side of the boat, got across it, and dove in again. And it was something very unusual. And the current also, as I said earlier, affected the times on all of the events. They made them all super fast, and they went down as Olympic records. And of course, in the next games, it was impossible to beat them.
In your research with it coming to the United States in 1904, was there, you know, was there something that was very interesting that you found about how the people of the United States embraced this Olympic game?
Well, it was very strange because Teddy Roosevelt was president in 1904, and he was worried that this Olympic business, which was growing from virtually nothing to quite a bit of interest. It wasn't like today, of course. And he made a decision. This has been awarded to us in Chicago. But I know there's going to be a great exposition in St. Louis. And if I put the two together, they would help each other. So I'm moving the games from Chicago to St. Louis. And that's what he did. Mm-hmm. And the people in the Olympics were concerned about the opposite effect, that all the American spectators would go to the exposition and nobody'd stick around to watch the sports. And actually that was an exaggeration, and they did coexist apparently with some success.
And it must have been interesting too at the time, because it's the first time they introduced a yard course. So there's a 110-yard course. There's a 220-yard freestyle, a 440-yard freestyle. Obviously,
well, Brent, there's a reason for that. And the reason is that the rules of the games were made up by the country where the games were held. There were no solid rules that you have to do this or you have to do that. And so the Americans said, well, we're a yards country, just like the British Empire and other countries. And by God, we're not going to swim meters. We don't even know what meters are. We heard it was something Napoleon invented about 100 years earlier. So we're just going to stick with good old yards and mile and that kind of stuff. And that's the reason they have this. And they went 110 rather than 100 because they said, well, this is the closest yards equivalent to 100 meters. And the same for 200 and 400. So we'll make the pool 110 yards long so that our own people and our spectators will have some idea of what this is. If we talk about 400 meters and 1,500 meters, they won't even know what we're talking about, so we're not going to do it.
Well, as you move further into the book, 1908 was the London Games, and here we're going to go back to London here in 2012. But between 1904 and 4 years later, they decided to host an interim games back in Athens, 1906. What was all behind that?
Well, they said that, you know, this Olympic thing can be pretty good. Why do we have to wait 4 years? Let's run an in-between games in Athens, where we started it all in 96, and see how we do. And so they did, and then they realized, if we have these every 2 years, there'll be, people will be too used to them, a little bit tired of them. Let's go back to 4 years. So after Athens, they had one already scheduled for London, and they couldn't change, but then they said, we will only have them every 4 years.
Now for somebody...
Go ahead.
For somebody who's going to go to the 2012 games in London, what kind of history can you bring to them, if they're listening here, to what was going on in 1908 in London that might be historical in perspective?
Well, first of all, I was at the games of 48. London's had this will be their third game.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't be there in 08 because I wasn't born. So that was a little bit of a barrier for me. But I was there in 48, and I had a wonderful experience. But in the 08 games, the main thing that happened is they all agreed this situation we have now is ridiculous. Every game, the events are different. We never have some events. Only came in one of those three games, and almost never were events repeated, and so the records were meaningless. The courses were different: rivers, oceans, lakes, swimming pools. I mean, we tried them all, and so then we decided we'd form an organization, which we called FINA because that stands for Fédération de Natation Amateur, French, and French was the prominent language of the world then. And so a bunch of guys got together, some athletes, some officials, and made some basic rules. And it sounded, this is a good thing, this FINA business. We're now going to standardize the events. We're also going to standardize how world records can be made. And just get some rules for the game. The thing that really killed everybody from the other countries, and there only were five or six other countries in those games, were the fact that the AAU, which was our multi-sport organization, swimming, track, all the Olympic sports were in the AAU. They were not separate federations. And so they decided to make things livelier in St. Louis. They would also make the meet the National AAU Championships for that year. Well, this was fine until we got to the relay. And then the Germans had a team, and we had four club teams.
Now, are you talking about the St. Louis games at this point, or
St. Louis games.
Okay, so 1904.
Yeah, I jumped ahead a little bit. This was another reason that forced us into FINA. And so everything was fine, and we came to the relay, and the Germans were all set to go. And the American club said, they can't swim. We've never had a nation compete in our national championships. Because to most of the clubs, it was the nationals. This Olympic thing, we don't know anything about it. All we know is New York AC is a very tough team, and the Olympic Club of San Francisco is a tough team, and that's what we're going to zero in on. We're not going to worry about the foreigners. So with all these conflicts, FINA came into being, and they got some good rules down and started running a meet that was 10 times better than any of those early ones.
Which showed up in 1908 then, at the first time it was in it.
08 was they had a 100-meter pool.
Which was outdoor in the Olympic Stadium.
Which was in the Olympic Stadium on the infield. You know, the way they mm-hmm. run a lot of the track events on the infield. Well, they decided to put in a 100-meter pool, four lanes wide, and to be able to have diving, they had an apparatus which they could fold down into the pool when the track races were going on.
Coach, let's go to 1912, the Stockholm Games. It's in Sweden. Once again, it's a standardized course, 100 meter, and it's outdoor. What sets that those games apart in your mind?
Well, the first thing was it was cold. I mean, the water off the coast of Sweden is chilly all times of the year, and there was no heating in these pools. And this was in the harbor of Stockholm, and they just set aside an area 100 meters long and about 6 or 8 lanes wide. And the lanes had no floats. They were just there, ropes. But it was a huge improvement. They had more nations. They had done more training. people knew what to expect. It was really a great improvement, even over London.
Two things jump out. One is the roster of names of the athletes who competed there, and two, the women events, which...
That's right. It was the first time women had been allowed in the games. And in swimming, they gave them two events, the 100-meter sprint and the 4x100 relay. Now, in the book is a wonderful picture of the British girls and their chaperone. They didn't allow coaches because coaches were professionals and Olympics were amateur, so they didn't want coaches that are paid money to be a part of the games.
Yeah, excellent, excellent photos throughout this book.
Pictures really help you a lot to absorb the atmosphere that really existed in that competition.
Now, do you recall who won the 100-meter freestyle in that event?
Oh, yes. One of the most famous all-time swimmers, Duke Kahanamoku from the Hawaiian Islands. Royal prince of the ruling family of those islands in the early days.
And when you go down a little further in that same event was a gentleman by the name of Max Ritter.
R. Max Ritter was a German swimmer on the German team, and he was one of the founders of FINA, even though he was only about 20 years old at the time. There were two or three athletes and two or three officials that decided about FINA. There were no coaches involved because of this professionalism business.
And where does Max stand as far as some technology improvements in our sport?
Well, Max was actually a very important person because it was his hobby for the rest of his long life. He lived to be about 90, and so he had 70 more years to go after London, and he got very interested and eventually became the president of FINA. When, as an American citizen, even though he had started his life in Germany, he came to U.S., started a very good business, and lived in Philadelphia and swam for the New York AC. He was a swimmer and water polo player for that club.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but did he not have some hands on timing devices?
Yes, he did. In 1960, we had a big incident in the 100-meter freestyle between John Devitt of Australia, who had been second in the Melbourne Games 4 years earlier in the 100, and Lance Larson, who swam for me at the Los Angeles Athletic Club and USC. And what happened in the race was the conditions of the finals were not good for one reason. The light hit the surface of the water and then jumped into your eyes, and the surface of the water looked like a silver surface. You could not see beneath the surface. And in the race itself, with the judges only making the decision, The timing was only to assist the press to know about how fast they're going. And so we had the race, and they were right together. Larson made his last touch underwater. If he and his coach had thought about it, they would have said, well, my hand goes out of sight. But of course they didn't. And they're both alive today, by the way. Coach is about 87, and Larson is a retired dentist. But the referee looked to the head judge and said, Henry, you'll have to call it because the judges are 3-3. 3 on one side picked Larson, 3 on the other side picked Devitt. So they had a problem, and the referee was a Swede from Borås, Sweden, and Henry was the general secretary of the Swedish Federation in Stockholm. Well, Henry was 5 meters down the pool. And how are you going to call a finish that stroke for stroke when you're 5 meters away from it? Not sideways, but lengthwise. So, he probably went, eeny, meeny, miny, mo, here I go. Anyway, a week later, I was in Stockholm in his office. I said, Mr. Rundströmer, my name is Daland, and I am the coach of Lance Larson. Then I shut my mouth. He jumped as if I was going to pull a gun on him. And I said, I come in friendship. What Max did, he invented a timing judging machine. And with his the technical people at his company, he built this thing and pulled it and shipped it down to Rome. And this was an unofficial timing machine, the same way the regular stopwatches were unofficial. And so this machine backed up the decision of the stopwatches, which put Larson a tenth of a second ahead of
them. Oh, my goodness. And I understand that that machine is in the International Swimming Hall of Fame as one of the exhibits in Fort Lauderdale.
Well, Max was then president of FINA. And he waged a 4-year campaign to get the judgment changed. And the Bureau wouldn't do it. And actually, he had no basis for this because his equipment was unofficial, and you can't use unofficial equipment to decide an Olympic contest.
Mm-hmm. Let's go up to 1916. You know, the world is... and World War One, and the games are scheduled to be in Berlin, Germany.
The games were canceled and postponed till the war ended. And when the war ended, there was great bitterness by the French and the English, and less by the Americans, because we were more, it was the European war. And they told the Germans they could not compete in the next 2 games. Because of the war they started.
What you presented right today is just a wonderful insight into this great piece of work, and it's not only great reading, but it's a wonderful historical document. I'd like to maybe bring you back on next week or so, and we'll pick up with the games in 1920 and talk a little bit about whether or not it was really going to proceed based on the war. World War One, but more importantly, for our listeners out there, United States Swimming published this book for Peter Daland, and you can buy it at USA Swimming. We have it at swimmingworldmagazine.com in our swim shop. Coach, is there anything you'd like to share with us before we end this particular segment of our interview?
Yes, I think it's wonderful that Swimming World, which we started at Yale in 51, is taking such a strong position on publicizing the Olympics. The Olympic swimming is what it's all about, and that hasn't changed in 100 years. It's still the meet in the minds of the athletes and the coaches and the parents and the spectators. So I think it's wonderful that you're publicizing Olympic swimming, and that was one of the things we first did. Kipeth and I went to the games on the expense account of the swimming world, which was a very marginal expense account, and we saw the games together in Helsinki. And now this tradition continues, swimming world and Olympic swimming.
Well, thank you for joining us today, Coach. We appreciate it and look forward to having you soon. This is Brent Rudemiller with Swimming World Radio.
Thank you, Brent.